Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled An Evolution of Urban Displacement, Concepts, Controversies, and Questions. I am delighted to be joined today by Dr. Jeff Crisp, who has held senior positions with UNHCR, Refugees International, and the Global Commission on International Migration. Jeff has firsthand experience of humanitarian operations throughout the world and has published and lectured widely on refugee and migration issues. He has a PhD in African Studies from the University of Birmingham and is currently a research fellow at the Refugee Studies Center in Oxford. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
So there are lots and lots of questions that I would love to ask you. Let's start with a set of discussions, given your long engagement with UNHCR and in this work on urban displacement. So I wanted to start by asking you, how do you think the understanding and approach to refugees in urban areas has changed in your experience, and why do you think that's been the case?
Sure, that's a great question, and let me answer it chronologically. I guess that for many years, basically from the early 1960s until the end of the 1990s, there was a widespread reluctance within the humanitarian community to address the issue of urban refugees. There was a general perception that refugees in developing countries were from a rural, agricultural and farming background, that they didn't really belong in cities and towns, and they simply wouldn't fit into an urban environment. Aid agencies found it more convenient and logistically more viable to keep refugees in camps and out of urban areas so that their basic needs could be met by means of large-scale relief programs. And those refugees who moved into cities were generally regarded as a bit of a nuisance. They tended to be the better educated and more articulate refugees. They were perceived as being more demanding and also more expensive to assist than those who remained in camps. At the same time, refugee hosting states were also very reluctant to let refugees into urban areas. They were seen as a potential threat to security. They were regarded as more difficult to control and to monitor. And refugee hosting states in the developing world also found it more convenient to have refugees living in highly visible camps, which made it easier to attract international assistance for them. At the same time, there was a general understanding, whether it was right or not is another matter, a general understanding amongst refugee hosting countries that if refugees were kept in camps and not allowed to move to urban areas, then it would be easier to repatriate them once conditions improved in their country of origin. So throughout that period I'm talking about, the 60s to the 90s, there was kind of a conspiracy between aid agencies such as UNHCR and refugee hosting countries in the developing world to keep refugees confined to camps, to place severe restrictions on their freedom of movement, and to prevent them moving into cities, towns, and urban areas in general. Now, carrying on the story, that situation began to change from the late 1990s onwards. During that period, a growing number of refugees were confined to camps, but there was mounting evidence that this was not good for them, that there were many negative consequences to refugees living in camps, particularly for women and children. And in response to deteriorating conditions in the camps where they were living, more and more refugees began to move out of the camps and to try and find a take up residence in urban areas, even in situations where they were prevented from doing so by national laws. Also, after the end of the 1990s, there was a growing amount of lobbying by NGOs and human rights movements on the question of freedom of movement for refugees. And this had a particular resonance with Antonio Guterres, who became the High Commissioner for Refugees in 2015. And in a meeting with me that year, he told it he found it very difficult to understand why UNHCR was colluding with refugee hosting states in confining refugees to camps and depriving them of freedom of movement. These trends culminated in two important policies on the part of UNHCR, a new policy on refugees in urban areas in 2009, and then another a policy on alternative to camps in 2014. And the important point about these two policies, that they both asserted in a very unambiguous manner that refugees did have the right to exercise freedom of movement, they did have the right not to live in camps, and they did have the right to take up residence in urban areas if that's what they chose to do so. And so since that time, we have seen a general reduction in the number of refugees living in camps and a general increase in the number of refugees living in urban areas. According to UNHCR, the number living in camps now amounts to around 20% of the total refugee population, while around 70% are currently to be found in urban areas. And that constitutes quite a major change from the situation up until the end of the 1990s.
Can I just say, I love the fact that you use the terms collusion and conspiracy. I'd be interested to know from your perspective how these changes in policies have impacted UNHCR's policies and work in urban areas and these alternatives to camps. So, you know, what do you think have been some of the constraints and challenges of implementing these sort of non-camp approaches that UNHCR has taken up?
I think those two policies were important and they did mark a distinct difference to the policies that have preceded them. It's actually quite difficult to know how successful or how effective those policies have been. And this is an area where there is real lack of research and evaluation and where much more work is to be done. I think I would argue that those policies have been quite successful to the extent that there now appears to be a much wider tolerance for the presence of refugees in urban areas of developing countries, certainly a greater tolerance than there was back in the 1960s, 70s and 1980s. I think it's also significant to take note of the fact that perhaps the largest refugee movement of recent years, namely the movement of refugees out of Syria, has involved refugee hosting countries that specifically did not want the most of the refugees arriving in their countries to be housed in camps. So, particularly in Jordan and Lebanon, for example, which hosted the largest number of Syrian refugees, as a result of their experience with Palestinian refugees, they were very reluctant to have refugees accommodated in camps and generally were prepared to let refugees live in the place of their choice, particularly in urban and semi-urban areas. So there has been, I think, a distinct and positive change in the general approach to urban refugees. At the same time, I think we do have to recognise that there are some serious obstacles to the implementation of urban-oriented strategy. And looking back at those two policies on urban refugees and alternative to camps, in which I was involved in both of them, I think there was a degree of wishful thinking in the way that they were drawn up. So there have been serious constraints encountered over the past decade or so implementation of these policies. Firstly, some refugee hosting states simply don't want refugees to live in urban areas and are determined to keep them confined to camps. The Rohingya refugees from Myanmar and Bangladesh would be a very good example of that particular position on the part of refugee hosting countries. Logistically, I think we have to recognise that it is still perhaps most easier to launch an effective emergency response through the establishment of camps when a very large number of people arrive in a country in a very short period of time, providing them with their basic needs when they're congregated in a single location and supply chains can be established to those camps is almost always easier than trying to reach a population that is dispersed across a very large and complex urban area. I think we've also found over the recent years that it's actually harder to monitor the protection and well-being of refugees who are scattered around a large urban area when refugees are confined to a camp and are right in front of aid agencies that are serving them. It's perhaps easier to monitor their welfare and to ensure that the most vulnerable refugees are being protected. Vulnerable refugees, I think experience shows, tend to get a little bit lost in the urban context and beyond the reach of aid agencies. And then I think when we talk about refugees in urban areas, we have to be a little bit more precise about what we're thinking. In most cases, experience demonstrates refugees cannot afford to live anywhere near the centre of major urban areas and cities. Refugees are often to be found in peri-urban areas where they're obliged to make very long and expensive journeys to UNHCR, other agencies and government departments that they are obliged to deal with. And there's been some interesting research undertaken in Nairobi, Kenya, for example, which demonstrates that refugees living in outlying peri-urban areas are often deprived of assistance and services simply because of the distance that they live from city centres. So when we talk about urban refugees, let's recognise that they're not living in the centre of cities, but often on the margins of urban areas.
That's a really, really good point. The fact that when we are looking at urban refugees, we are actually seeing them living in the peripheries of cities. And these are also quite poor areas in many parts of the world, not all. And many of the residents there also share many of the challenges that refugees would have. They also face
exactly.
a series of deprivations as well.
And in a camp context, we're very used to talking about the refugee population on the one hand and the host population on the other. When you get to a large and complex urban area, that distinction, I think, begins to be a little bit problematic. When people are living alongside each other in the same neighbourhoods, perhaps even in the same houses or compounds, does it make sense to actually make a distinct difference between refugees and the host population?
And I think that there's something to be discussed here in terms of thinking about, you know, does it actually make sense? And what does that mean then for humanitarian action? Like, do you then intervene in these areas or do you not? Or how do you intervene in these areas? So I think these are sorts of conversations that are becoming increasingly salient.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very big issue. UNHCR at the end of the day is a refugee agency and has to target and prioritise refugees in its activities. But in an urban area where, as I've just said, people are living alongside each other, in close proximity to each other, does it make sense to have programmes specifically targeted at refugees while ignoring the other members of the local community?
Yes, exactly. There's also sort of a counter discussion that goes on quite a lot about camps becoming cities. So I'm curious to know what your views are on this.
Yeah, that's a really good question. This idea that camps are gradually becoming cities has become an increasingly popular notion over the past decade. And there's been a number of influential books and articles written on this topic, particularly about the way that large camps such as Zaatari in Jordan and Kakuma in Kenya, Domes in northern Iraq, about the way that they have allegedly or ostensibly taking on the features of cities or urban areas. It's an interesting and in some ways an attractive proposition, but let me make a few slightly skeptical comments about it. Firstly, these comments that camps are becoming cities are often based on size alone, with commentators pointing out that places such as Kakuma and Zaatari have as many inhabitants as the major other towns living in Kenya and Jordan. And I'm not sure that size alone is an adequate indicator of urbanization. So in that respect, I would be a little bit cautious about saying refugees are becoming camps. I think in describing camps as cities or saying that camps are becoming cities, it would be quite useful to have a common understanding or definition of what a city or what an urban area is. And that seems to be somewhat lacking in the literature. So before we make the comparison, perhaps we should also try to define what we're talking about, exactly what a city or an urban area is, so that we can actually apply that definition to a camp and see if it's applicable or not. And then my other point would be that I think there's a severe risk of normalization in calling refugee camps cities or suggesting that they're becoming cities. Some commentators have certainly suggested that camps are becoming cities because of the wide range of goods and services that are traded there, and the fact that they're characterized by all kinds of infrastructure, such as shops, restaurants, sporting and recreational facilities, water supply systems, and street lighting. In other words, all the kind of characteristics you would normally find in a city or an urban area. But I think we have to recognize that people living in these camps remain refugees, and that they continue to have rights denied to them that citizens of host countries are normally able to exercise. So I think we have to be careful in saying that camps are becoming cities. We're normalizing what remains an essentially abnormal situation for the refugees living there. At the same time, and on the other hand, it's also been pointed out that even in these refugee hosting countries, citizens may not actually be able to exercise the full range of rights into which they're entitled. And in that respect, refugees are not entirely different. So one could argue that that actually adds some weight to the notion that refugee camps are taking on the characteristics of cities. So in conclusion on this issue, I'd say that the notion that camps can become or are becoming cities, it's quite an eye-catching one. It's quite an inviting one, but I think it needs a little bit more careful thought before we start to use it as a general assumption.
I think that's a very clear sort of position to take on it. Going back to a point that you had made a little bit earlier about the question of repatriation, and you had mentioned that camps might serve aid agencies or UNHCR or host countries better in terms of repatriation. I wanted to sort of unpack that question a little bit and just ask you what you think, you know, the role of different geographies are in refugee repatriation. Like, do you think urban areas have a role to play in refugee repatriation in comparison to, say, camps? How does perhaps camp living impact where refugees want to live if they're repatriated? I mean, I know you have your position on the camp not being urban, but is there something urban about the camp that you think is important? Is there something about sort of an urban experience in the camp that you think is relevant to refugee repatriation? I suppose there's probably an age question there as well in terms of thinking about generations of people who've been in camps, because we are looking at people who increasingly spent protracted periods of time being displaced and being placed in camps.
Let me address this issue for a couple of minutes. In fact, very little has been written about this issue of the relationship between camps, urban areas, and repatriation. And the evidence base on which I'm making my comments is quite slim. So what I'm going to say for the next minute or two is really based on essentially anecdotal evidence. It's certainly an area where I would encourage people to undertake more research. For many years, there was a general expectation that when refugees went back to their country of origin, they would return to the rural areas and the villages from which they and their families originated. And if refugees did go back to their country of origin and failed to remain in their rural areas and the villages from which they came, this would be taken as to denote that the integration or the reintegration process had failed, and that this was failure on the part of the aid agencies concerned. And in response to this scenario, whereby people were going back to their own country and not going back to rural areas but moving into cities, in response to this kind of scenario, UNHCR started to implement what it called quick impact projects in rural areas of return, with the hope that this would, what they said, would anchor returnees in the rural areas from which they originated. And I think looking back over the years and in retrospect, this perception was somewhat mistaken. I think, as I've already said, over the recent years, we've seen that a growing proportion of refugees are living in urban areas rather than in camps. And so it's not surprising, perhaps, they should want to return to an urban lifestyle after they've gone back to their country of origin. On one hand, it could be argued that living in a camp of perhaps 100,000 or even 200,000 people is essentially a urban or a quasi-urban experience. Why should we expect refugees who have become accustomed to or have been born in densely populated settlements with a wide range of services at their doorstep to return to a remote and isolated village where relatively little is going on and where relatively few services are available, where the opportunities for social and economic interaction are very limited. And as you've already hinted in your earlier comments, I think there's a generational thing going on here. What I've seen in certain situations is that in situations where it does become viable for refugees to go back to their own country, younger refugees who have been born and brought up in camps are perhaps so accustomed to a quasi-urban lifestyle that they're very reluctant to go back to a rural area in their country of origin, whereas their parents and perhaps even their grandparents might have a kind of a more romantic attachment or emotional attachment to their place of origin and are more willing to go back to a rural area. And I'm not sure that aid agencies and planning repatriation and reintegration programs have taken due account of this kind of generational difference. So certainly this is an area where more research is needed, and particularly applied research looking at the way in which the demographics of return should shape and influence the establishment of return and reintegration programs for refugees.
I think that's a really interesting idea, and you're right that that's not something that many of us think about when we are thinking about that question of urban refugees. But I am a bit surprised that repatriation processes have not looked at where people are going when they go back, and is driven by an assumption that they will simply go back to areas that they had left from and not instead want to move somewhere else, especially to urban areas, especially if people have been displaced for a really long time. So that is...
I don't think we should go to the other extreme and say it's necessarily a positive thing if people go to urban areas. Afghanistan would be a very good example of a situation where large numbers of people have gone back to Afghanistan. A lot of them have kind of drifted towards urban areas and now basically living in shanty and squatter settlements on the fringes of the major towns, largely because they haven't been able to make a go of it in rural areas. So again, we shouldn't be naive and unnecessarily positive about refugees going back to urban areas in their country of origin. If they go back to urban areas, then one would certainly hope that they are living a viable lifestyle and livelihoods at their disposal, which, from what I know of Afghanistan, does not seem to be the case.
I think we've talked quite a bit about that question around refugees, and I wanted to, as a sort of closing question, turn the conversation a little bit to looking at IDPs. Again, another sort of controversial concept given also rural-urban migration. So I wanted to ask you whether you thought this was a useful concept of talking about urban IDPs, and again, what you thought the implications were for operations for UN agencies.
Well, there has certainly been a growing tendency in recent years, over the past decade, I would say, to talk about urban IDPs and to use this as a category and to emphasize and perhaps even to exaggerate their numbers. And I think we need to be a little bit cautious on this issue, for a number of specific reasons. Firstly, the IDP concept is itself quite a loose and quite a problematic one. It doesn't constitute a legal category. And in an urban context, it's not always easy to say if someone is an IDP or not. I often use the example of Haiti. Are people who are living in the rubble of their houses, which have been destroyed by an earthquake, should they be counted as IDP or not, even if they haven't moved? They're certainly living in IDP-like conditions. So defining an IDP and knowing who is an IDP and who is not is in general a problematic issue, and it becomes particularly problematic, I would argue, in the urban context. Many of the countries where there are significant numbers of internally displaced people are also countries characterized by large-scale rural to urban migration. And I think it's often quite difficult to disentangle people who have moved from rural to urban areas for primarily economic reasons, those who have moved as a result of armed conflict and human rights abuses, and those who have moved as a result of climate change and natural disasters. So again, distinguishing particularly so-called urban IDPs from other rural to urban migrants is an issue that needs a little bit additional thought. Thirdly, I'd argue that there is some evidence, especially from Latin America and Central America, that displaced people who find themselves in urban areas and who move to urban areas do not necessarily want to be identified as such and feel that they may be at risk or have a stigma associated if they are described as and recognized and categorized as IDPs. So I think we have to be careful about kind of foisting a category or label on people who do not want it to be described in that way themselves. And then finally, on this issue of urban IDPs, there's been a lot of discussion over the last 20 years without any real resolution on the question of when somebody ceases to be an IDP and should no longer be counted as such and categorized as such. And I think this is a particularly pertinent issue in the urban context. And if I could just finish my answer to this question on a very brief anecdote. Some time ago, I was in Luanda in Angola, and I was driving through the city with a driver. And at one point, he pointed to a settlement by the side of the road, and he said, "Oh, that's where the IDPs live." And I said, "Well, how long have they been there?" And he turned to me and said, "Well, they've been there about 30 years, which really begs the question as to whether a population that's been living more or less in the same place and clearly has settled in a particular place for three decades, should they still be described as internally displaced, or should we recognise that they have made a new home in that particular location?"
I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think one of the things that I've been working on is really to think about, you know, what is that question of citizenship when we look at these questions around displacement, including this point that you made about IDPs. At what point is a person displaced and not considered a citizen with the same kinds of rights as others?
Yeah.
And of course, people need different things at different points in time. So of course, you know, when they are displaced to a particular place, they might need certain kinds of assistance and support at a particular time. But 30 years, as you mentioned, is a long time to consider someone to be an IDP. And it's interesting that there's no discussion of when that IDP status actually goes away.
As a general point, I think I would conclude by saying that perhaps those of us who work in the world of refugees and displacement have got perhaps a little bit too obsessed by the issue of movement and location. And perhaps we should focus more on needs and rights rather than movement and location. And in designing programs for people, whether they're described as displaced or refugees or not, we need to look firstly at what needs they have and what rights they are deprived of, rather than where they've moved from and to and where their current location is. So in the design of programs, particularly for IDPs and for urban refugees, it will probably make a lot more sense not to focus on the legal category or status of the people concerned, but their needs and rights, and try and address them in the most effective way possible. That's going to be difficult because the whole humanitarian system is structured around agency mandates and categories of people in need, and it's going to be very difficult to move away from that. But to the extent that we can, I think we should.
Yes, especially as we see, you know, more of these kinds of issues around climate change and conflict and migration and so forth taking place. It is a much more complicated lens. Neither does it make sense, nor is it just to actually separate people out in this way, because it might be all these kinds of overlapping issues. So I think we do need a new and different way to think about, you know, what is the future of this?
Yeah. And in fact, in the refugee and displacement world, there's a lot of talk at the moment about social inclusion. And one could argue that by targeting particular groups of people in a specific area, that you're actually running counter to the notion of social inclusion, and that social inclusion demands an area-based approach rather than an approach based on specific categories of people who belong in some way or another to particular aid agencies.
Yes, that's a really, really good point. And we are seeing this area-based process taking place more and more, but I think there's a lot more work to be done here as well. But that's a really interesting way of sort of thinking about that area-based approach that is taking place. Well, thank you, Jeff, for your time with us today. We really appreciate it. It's been really interesting to hear your analysis of how things have changed over the last several decades. And obviously, like in your experience, you've seen so many different changes. And thank you for sharing all the stories and the analysis with us. It's been an extremely interesting conversation here.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.